Congressman Don Manzullo, what kinds of jobs would you like to see created in your district?
Well, obviously, it's well-paying jobs, jobs that are sufficient to keep our kids here so they don't have to move away to bigger cities in order to have employment. I've prepared what's called an American Jobs Agenda. People can get it at manzullo.org. It's a very comprehensive 10-point plan on returning America back to work, obviously with a heavy emphasis upon manufacturing because we're a manufacturing area. But what business people are looking for is certainty. Certainty in the workforce, certainty in taxation, a certainty in what's expected of them of health care. I have visited hundreds of factories all over northern Illinois and other types of small businesses, and it's the same theme over and over and over again. Businessmen just don't want to do anything because of the uncertainty of not knowing the impact that Obamacare is going to have upon them, and also the uncertainty of not knowing what the next tax rate is going to be or the next regulations that's going to hit them. So this creates a stagnation in the economy. That means that the jobs don't grow.
I'd like to learn more about what role should the federal government play in creating those jobs?
Well, the federal government creates the environment through the tax structure, the regulatory structure, by making it as conducive as possible for businesses to grow with the least amount of government interference. That's probably the easiest answer to give, but it's probably about the most comprehensive answer that can be given. Sure, there are tax breaks that come in once in a while. An example would be the bonus depreciation. It comes around every few years where people would buy a piece of machinery and be able to write it off over a shorter period of time. And those help. I mean, they really do. Those are incentives that would increase people buying machinery to make them more productive, to make them more competitive, and therefore to create more jobs.
Turning to foreign policy, what foreign policy issues do you see as paramount for the U.S.?
Goodness gracious, where do you want to start? we still have to figure out what the bear is going to do, what Russia. I mean, things are not that sweet in Mother Russia, especially with Putin at the controls. He still is not what we would call a free market person. He has to be watched very carefully. But Russia, along with China, I serve as the only Illinois member of Congress who sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and have obviously spent a lot of time studying foreign affairs. I chaired the U.S.-China Interparliamentary Exchange for years and had the opportunity to meet with several Chinese presidents. China is obviously a big problem. You never know what they're going to do. I'm a commissioner on the Legislative Executive Commission on Human Rights that was established when China went into the WTO for the purpose of following and analyzing human rights violations in China. And it gets worse. China becomes more closed. It's just the most amazing thing in the world. You would think that with so much so many businesses being involved in Chinese and American products, people going back and forth, a lot of students from China visiting the United States and actually studying here, that China would gradually begin to become more and more open. It's not happened. Many thought that would happen. There's no desire for democracy in China, at least on the part of the rulers. The people are in a state of subjugation. But locally, we see some improvements in some local elections and people starting to believe that they can actually control their destinies. This is a culture that has to be changed. China does not have the appreciation for personal property. They think everything belongs to the state, and it does under their system. If you don't appreciate personal property, then you don't appreciate the fact that what the mind thinks, the ingenuity of the mind, the inventiveness of the mind, the personality of the mind, the privacy of the mind, is not considered to be a property right in China. Just an entirely different culture. But obviously one to watch because of China's expansion into the South China Sea, China's use of cutting back on rare earth mineral shipments to Japan for processing because of disputes over the Spratlys. And China continued to exert its strength in that part of the world. It's quite a, you know, it's very, very interesting. But we have to be aware all the time of what's going on with China. Look at their expansion in Cuba into the oil rig business and drilling not too far from our shores. I don't know where you can bounce from Russia to China. And you obviously have to go to the Middle East to see what's going on there. Israel is in an extraordinarily difficult position. It does not believe that it has much time before Iran, in fact, develops fissionable material, which over a period of time could be turned into making a nuclear warhead. Ahmadinejad is driven by his Shia form of Muslim religion, but he's also a member of the Twelver, T-W-E-L-V-E-R. The Twelvers believe that there will be the return of the 12th Caliphate, whose job it is to stir up all the Arab countries and then to eliminate Satan, which is Israel, and the great Satan, which is the United States. I mean, this is a very scary man. He's the leader of Iran. And you can bounce all over Africa from Iran on what to do there. Sanctions have been imposed. We have a carrier there. Ahmadinejad is talking about closing the Straits of Hormuz. It's obviously impacting the price of oil. As I've studied what's happened all over, let's say, North Africa and the Middle East, we have to go back to a speech that President Obama gave in June of 2009 in Cairo. And just wonder exactly what was he talking about. Did he go there to stir up or start the Arab Spring? I don't think he's prescient. But there was an opportunity later that year with the Green Revolution that was attempting to take place in Iran. And the president should have seized the opportunity to encourage the students who were in the streets that they should rise up and into a revolution against Ahmadinejad. That would have been a good thing on the part of the president to do, but he didn't do that. He didn't take the opportunity. He got into Libya and decided to violate the War Powers Act. I voted against three resolutions on invading Libya, even if boots were not on the ground, providing support. And now we don't even know who these guys are that are in charge of Libya. It's great that Gaddafi is gone. But then just shoot over to Egypt. Mubarak is gone, but 47% of the parliamentary seats have been captured by the Muslim Brotherhood, which started Hamas, and 25% of the seats in Egypt have been captured by the Salafites. But Israel is obviously very agitated over, very concerned over what's going on in Iran, because they just know that if Iran gets that warhead, it could be very, very dangerous.
If one looks at the media reports carefully, one gets the impression that Israel appears to be asking for American help, or at least advice regarding Iran. Do you get that impression as well? And if so,
well, it is the Israel does not have the bunker buster bombs that the U.S. does, and I would not put it off the table that if our intelligence definitely comes to a conclusion that the only way to stop Iran from getting a nuclear warhead is to bomb a certain area, that will happen. And I would support that. And I'm not a person who's an interventionist because of my position on Libya, my position on staying out of Syria, et cetera. But if Ahmadinejad gets a nuclear warhead, it's going to be absolute total chaos because all the other Arab countries will want to get the same thing. And we just can't have that type of proliferation of nuclear weapons.
I'd like to turn to domestic energy.
Okay.
What course should the United States take on domestic energy?
The goal is to become as free as possible from dependence upon hostile countries for our oil. You recall what happened back in the 60s. And the 70s with the shortage of oil, and now we're even more dependent upon foreign oil. In fact, the Department of Energy was formed for the purpose of making us less dependent upon foreign oil. That's not happened. We're even more dependent upon foreign oil. The president has to come to the realization that the American people are not impressed with how he does obeisance to certain groups. There's no reason not to build that Keystone XL pipeline. The people in Nebraska have resolved themselves that issue of the routing of the pipeline. Do you remember that? It was going over a marsh or somewhere that was sensitive. That's been taken care of. It's been studied for 3.5 years. I chair the U.S.-Canadian Interparliamentary Exchange and was talking to the member of parliament from Alberta, where the tar sands are, Rob Merrifield, a very good friend of mine. And he said, Don, if the United States does not build that Keystone pipeline, the Canadian government, as per the promise of Prime Minister Stephen Harper, is going to build that pipeline all the way to Vancouver and make it available for selling to the Chinese. This is dumb. I mean, why wouldn't we want to take advantage of getting oil from a country as friendly as Canada? But no, the president insists on not doing it. He signed an agreement 2 days ago, supposedly open up some area in the Gulf of Mexico for drilling, and that's nowhere near what has to be done. Right off the coast of Alaska, giant reserves of oil. He has a complete ban on drilling there. And so we just become more and more dependent upon foreign oil. Solar cars don't exist. Electric cars to date are really a joke. I mean, the Volt costs the taxpayer, I think, $7,500 or $8,500 in a tax break for the purchaser of the car. It goes maybe 30 to 40 miles before it runs out of electrical power. I mean, we should work towards that technology, but that's a long way off. But it's something that still should be explored. But I'm totally opposed to direct subsidies for energy. And my opponent voted in one of his votes to spend $3.5 billion to subsidize Solyndra type of facilities. The same with the wind production. You know, the time for subsidizing these windmills is over. We don't need that. We don't need anybody else to say, here's a new type of energy. It needs a whole new burst of money to go into it from the taxpayer, because there's enough people out there that are already in the process of doing that. And so it's really an all of the above approach. Every possible source of energy we should tap. I'm involved in something very interesting where people, where sometimes it takes a little movement in Congress, not as a matter of legislation, but using my congressional position as co-chair of the Manufacturing Caucus to bring people's attention to something, to the fact that you can save a lot of energy through something called mechanical insulation. Now, mechanical insulation is where you wrap pipes, heating pipes and cooling pipes. And we've been working with the people that install the insulation, people who make the insulation, the straps, engineers that design it, and formed this coalition. And the state of Montana was picked by this group to study what they could save in energy. And they found about 7,500 points where they could actually wrap the pipes. It cost less than 4 years for payback on wrapping the pipes, and it saves 7 to 8% a year in energy. That's astounding. And it had nothing to do with oil exploration or anything. It's just a matter of insulation and taking what we have, making buildings a lot more energy efficient. It's absolutely astounding what you can save in energy. And that doesn't involve drilling or anything controversial like that. So we have to move in all fronts. And I've been involved in that, and it's always a joy to see somebody coming up with the next machine that can save a lot of energy.
I want to go back a few minutes ago. You mentioned a vote taken by your opponent, Congressman Adam Kinzinger,
right,
regarding Solyndra. Could you just flesh that out
a
little bit more?
One of the issues in this campaign is who's the more conservative member of Congress. And I've seen his TV ads in his latest 12, 14-page newspaper trying to say that Don Manzullo is not a conservative. Well, you can't be in Congress for 19 years and have a 96% rating by the American Conservative Union unless you're a conservative. And I've been endorsed by every conservative organization there is. It's important because people want somebody in there who's not going to squander money. I put together a vote analysis that I voted 79 more times in 2011 to cut $209 billion more than Adam Kinzinger. You can go to my website, manzullo.org. It pulls up all the votes side by side. This is how you determine how a person's going to vote based upon what he does with that voting card. This has never been refuted, and you can go through point by point, and I'll leave you a copy of these, where it shows that he is continuously involved in spending more money. I mean, for example, there was an opportunity to eliminate the Institute of Peace. This is just an incredible waste of money. $30 million. He voted to keep it. I voted to get rid of it. All types of votes that are taken and chronicled, and that's why we assiduously sat down and compared the votes of my opponent with myself. And so it's the issue is not the person who talks about cost cutting, but the person who actually does it. It's remarkable. I've been in Congress since January of 1993. I got the endorsement of the Illinois Tea Party. I mean, those are pretty conservative folks. And they say unequivocally Don Manzullo is the more conservative of the two opponents, of the two candidates. But at the same time, and this has a lot to do with the jobs we're talking about, a member of Congress is expected to be intimately involved in trying to build wealth within the communities that he represents. Several years ago, I was part of the group that actually planned, got the initial financing for the Rochelle Intermodal Hub. It's the largest footprint of any hub in the country. I put together Union Pacific with the city of Rochelle in order to get that hub going and still work on it from time to time. And today it's spawned $1.5 billion in private investment and over 5,000 new jobs. I mean, what kind of congressman is this who has a 96% conservative rating in Congress and yet who spends so much time developing economic opportunities for the people he represents? That's who I am. I've always been a hands-on person involved in that, and I've used my post as chairman of the subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific on the Foreign Affairs Committee to help bring Nippon Shiro. It's a Japanese company that will create 400 jobs to build the metro. That's going to be in the industrial park, and what's probably even more significant for a lot of farmers here in the area is I use that position on Foreign Affairs to help broker the Illinois portion of a $5 billion grain deal with the country of Taiwan. I'm hands-on. I'm always involved in economic development. I've visited hundreds of factories, helping factories become more efficient, helping them get certified to sell things such as aircraft parts. And you don't see me on Fox TV talking about how bad the other guys are. I'm just too busy helping out the people that I represent.
I want to go back to just that thing we were talking about. You mentioned your opponent and Solyndra and a tax credit in the same sentence. Can you just flesh
that out? Yeah, because the type of program that I voted to kill, he voted to keep, and that's the one that gives direct subsidies for these so-called energy companies. $3.5 billion. I mean, the federal government's got no business being involved in giving a direct grant to a company to start a business. Any new business or old business obviously has the regular tax breaks, such as depreciation and things of that nature, and those would stay there. But to pick winners and losers, to go out and to choose that, it's akin to the president's new plan to give different types of cuts for manufacturers based upon what they make. I mean, do me a favor. The president now will determine what's high tech. So if you're in high tech, you get this particular tax break. If not, you get this particular tax break. That's just too confusing. We don't need that. So just get rid of those tax breaks.
For this next topic, there is no easy segue at all. It's labor management relations. What is your position on right-to-work laws?
I believe in right-to-work laws because I believe in freedom of association. I joined a union when I played rock and roll in high school, the Ventrells. I played bass. And that experience, it was a little bit different than most labor unions today because the union I belonged to served as a place where you could actually get your gigs, get your jobs. But the cost of it, I mean, I was 16 years old. In high school, it was $40. It was 1960. That was a tremendous amount of money for a kid to pay. What I don't like is the fact that people have to be forced to join unions. That should be a matter of choice. The freedom of association is also in the First Amendment. That's where I have a problem with states where it's mandatory that you join the labor union.
A related question, what should be the relationship between governments and their employee unions?
Well, I think one of the biggest drivers of costs that we see today are the government unions. The unions traditionally have been involved in manufacturing and in carpentry and the building trades and everything. Now you have the largest growing segment of unions is in the service industry. I think that's one of the things that has really spiked and made it very difficult for governors and mayors to be able to streamline the employer relations that are going on. I say that based upon the fact that there are people in unions of all persuasions. In Illinois, because it's mandatory. I mean, we have a lot of people working our campaign are very conservative Republicans. Don't like the fact that they have to join a union, but say, well, that's just what we have to do. There is no one, quote, union person. I don't believe that that people should be given a definition of who they are based upon the fact that they belong to a labor union. My dad belonged to Local 792 as a carpenter's union. And everything has to do with whether or not that membership is voluntary, because I study the Constitution very assiduously, and I just have a problem with being forced to join a labor union. It carries over to the fact that I voted against the Patriot Act on reauthorization twice. I don't think it's the government's business to go to the NIU library and look at the checkout to see what books somebody is checking out. It's just too far. It's too intrusive, too invasive. So you can see my real conservative libertarian streak coming out, because I just believe we need as much government as possible in order to keep us as small as possible, if that makes sense.
I'd like to turn to social issues.
Okay.
How far should the federal government go in dealing with abortion rights?
Well, there's obviously nothing in the Constitution dealing with abortion that would leave it a state issue. However, the Supreme Court made it a federal issue in Roe versus Wade. And so I'm on a bill that would have a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe versus Wade. It's not just being pro-life and making the statement and then moving on to something else. Frieda and I formed the Rockford Crisis Pregnancy Center, now called Rockford Care Center, where women who had to make this very difficult decision would have open arms to walk them through it, somebody to help take care of their kids, a whole host of social services. And I was the president of the Rockford Area Crisis Pregnancy Center for 3 years. That actually spawned the one in Freeport and the one in DeKalb today. To be pro-life means that you really have to be involved in working in the community to help women work through that decision, regardless of whether or not they decide to carry full term or to abort their child. And we opened that social service center, worked at it for years and years, because it's very important that women need that type of support.
What role should the federal government have regarding marriage?
Well, you know, the Supreme Court ruled years ago against polygamy. Somewhere along the line, somebody has to take a standard and say, this is how we're going to live as a society and live as a country. I believe that marriage should be between a man and a woman. What's the source of that? It's a standard. Sometimes there's no source for it. You can look all over the place and say, well, what's the source of the federal government taking a position on polygamy, which it has? It's just that society looks at something and says that this is right and this is wrong, and you have to have a standard. And so I just think that the standard should be that marriage should be between a man and a woman. Now, that does not mean that there can't be contractual relations between anybody, because there's also a freedom of contract provision in the Constitution. And there's no reason why people of the same sex can't buy homes, can't have wills, leaving things to each other, can't have insurance policies, can't have living wills. I mean, these are available, and that could fill that vacuum, as it were, for people who are of the same sex that are interested in becoming married.
A quick question, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Does that mean that you would support a federal civil unions
no.
law?
No. I'm just talking about existing contractual law that's guaranteed under the Constitution. Constitution cannot discriminate as to people that want to buy a home together, for example. So, no, absolutely opposed to a civil union.
Turning to the economy, what do you see as the right approach to reducing the national debt?
Well, several things. This campaign has shown that I'm really the only candidate who's interested in cutting spending, balancing the budget, and paying down the national debt. With that lifetime 96% American Conservative Union voting rating, it really indicates how I voted in my time in Congress, very conservatively. You only vote for that which is absolutely necessary. And so that's where you start, is with cutting that spending. Second thing we have to do is take a look at the entitlement programs. There are all kinds of plans out there on reforming entitlements. In fact, there was a bill that came up at the budget time last year in March. The Republican Study Committee, which is where all the conservatives meet, came up with our own budget that would have cut $9 trillion in spending over 10 years and began to balance the budget in 10 years without harming Social Security, Medicare, or anything. Only four of us in Illinois voted for that. It was Congressman Walsh, Tim Johnson, who's just south of us, Congressman Shimkus, who's at the southern part of the state, and I, just four of us. Adam Kinzinger did not vote for it. In fact, he voted for the Ryan plan, which I also voted for, but the Ryan plan doesn't even start to balance the budget until 2030. That's a long way out. And the Republican Study Committee came up with the budget. That's for the Conservative Republicans Caucus. I'm with that group. Adam Kinzinger left that group. He caucuses with the moderates and receives money from the moderates in Congress, from their PAC. I'm just pointing these out to show the tremendous differences between the two of us.
This next question is about you.
Okay.
What sets you apart as the best choice for the nomination?
People expect a lot of things out of a congressman. First of all, they want somebody who can vote right, and I've done that correctly. But they want somebody with life experiences that they can bring into Congress and relate into the people that they represent. Let me give you three instances. I was born and raised in small business. Dad had a grocery store. We lived in one room for 6 years above the grocery store. Then he bought the old Rosecrans Children's Home in New Milford, converted that into Manzullo's famous Italian restaurant with 13 tables and a bar that my dad built because he was a master carpenter. My brother and I worked there. I worked my way through college and law school. And when you work for your dad, you can't quit and he won't fire you. It was quite an experience. I was the day manager at the drive-in restaurant. And when I graduated from law school, most of my colleagues wanted to go to, quote, the major law firms in the big cities. And I wanted to return to my rural roots because I was raised in New Milford, a tiny town just south of Rockford. I set up a shingle in Oregon, Illinois, and established my own small business, represented a lot of small businesses. And so people want somebody with a small business background to take to Congress so you understand what's going on with small businesses. And I chaired the Small Business Committee for 3 terms. Congressman Kinzinger stated about a month ago before a group of small business people that he knows nothing about small businesses, but he's willing to learn. You know, it's very difficult to do that. And so I bring that small business background in because the job growth is all in small business. Second of all, my wife and I have lived on a farm for years. I raised beef cattle. And this is a huge agricultural area. I practice agricultural law when I practice law, representing farmers that were head-on in disputes with the EPA, IRS, et cetera. And when you take a look at, especially DeKalb County, which has, well, let's face it, we've got the best corn and beans in the country in Illinois. It's important for a member of Congress to know what an amber box is, a blue box is, and a green box for WTO compliance when working on the new farm bill. I had that background in agriculture. He has no background in agriculture. And then finally, in manufacturing, I've been recognized as the point person in the U.S. House of Representatives. In fact, Manufacturer Magazine calls me Mr. Fix-It. There's a caricature of me with a hard hat and holding a wrench, saying, Washington's Mr. Fix-It. And I work on manufacturing issues most of my time. I'm responsible for a tax law that gives a 9% tax deduction for all entities that manufacture in the United States. That's quite an accomplishment to do something like that. 4 years ago, I put together an export control working group. I did most of the work, changed Section 17C of the Export Administration Act. I worked on 2 years on two sentences. As a result of that change in regulation, today we sell billions of dollars more of U.S.-made parts overseas. And I'm responsible for that change, and I received the Wings of Liberty Award from the Aerospace Industry Association. You don't hear a lot of this stuff because it's so technical. But I think that people want somebody also with a manufacturing background to understand what's going on, and there's a lot of, I mean, huge amounts of manufacturing in the 16th Congressional District. It's that practical experience. It's that solid conservative voting record that sets me aside from Congressman Kinzinger.
This is the last question. What other issues do you see as important to this district, the state, and the nation?
Well, obviously, we could talk a lot more about job creation, and I absolutely cannot complete the things that I would do for job creation, and so I would refer the listeners to manzullo.org to get the American Jobs Agenda, which spells out in 10 points things that we need in terms of regulatory fixes, keeping taxes low, reforming health care, et cetera. But if you take a look at all the issues that are going on in the country today, health care is still a big issue. It's a huge issue. It's one of the drivers of the economy not expanding the way it should. I know of business people that are right around 50 employees. When Obamacare kicks in, they're going to be below 50 because they want to be free of the mandate. That doesn't make sense. Other employers don't know what's expected of them. Health insurance premiums were supposed to be going down. Now they're going to be up. Now they're going to be up, and people are very, very upset over the fact that the president thinks he has the authority to order insurance companies to provide services free of charge. This is in the dispute with the Catholic Church. How does a president get authority like that?
These are the contraceptive services.
Yes, and abortifacient services, mm-hmm. and sterilization. And so we see this giant Obamacare bill. This thing's got to be repealed. Nancy Pelosi said, you won't know what's in it until you pass it. Well, you know what? I voted against that thing. But there are a lot of things that we can do to replace Obamacare that are really critical for job growth in this country, such as allowing sale of health insurance across state lines, allowing association health plans so small businesses can band together and buy insurance as though they were a large group, having community health centers, which really help out for people that absolutely have nowhere else to turn, funding state programs where people simply cannot get insurance. It's allowing for health savings plans, and of course meaningful tort reform when it comes to liability insurance, which could suck up about $52 billion worth of cost of insurance premiums, and in preventive medicine. These are all free market approaches to replacing Obamacare. That is a huge subject and still has to be on the table. The Obamacare has to be repealed and can start over and pass all these laws, all these ideas I just passed incrementally, which we did in the House several times, but they go to the Senate and they all died.
Congressman Don Manzullo, thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.